The Tom Woods Show, episode 1554.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Welcome back to Gene Epstein Week. And today we're going to be talking about books that Gene thinks are important that have had an impact on him. So I'm going to be referring to a list he sent me, and then we'll post that at tomwoods.com/1554. Again, by now, I'm sure you guys all know Gene Epstein, formerly economics and book review editor at Barron's, and currently director of the Soho Forum, which is such an amazing debate series in New York on such interesting topics. So you'll want to check that out for sure at thesohoforum.org. And if you attend one of their debates in person, just find Gene. He's not hard to find. And say Tom Woods, and you'll get a free drink at the bar. Gene, welcome back.
Good to be back, Tom.
All right, let's talk books. We're going to talk books today. And you've sent me a list that we can't possibly get to. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a handful of these books. These are books that influenced your intellectual development.
That's correct, yes.
And we're going to put on the show notes page the whole list, even the ones we don't get to here. So everybody who's curious about what are all the Epstein books that he wanted to talk about, they will all be listed and linked at tomwoods.com/1554 if you'd like to look at them. So I think I'm not going to do The Case Against Education by Brian Kaplan.
Okay,
only because you've talked about it on the show before.
Yeah, okay.
I did an episode with Brian on it, and then I did an episode with you on it.
Okay.
So I think we'll just refer people to that in the list of episodes you've done with me.
Yeah.
So and then the Noam Chomsky book we've covered a bit in the past. And Man, Economy, and State, and Four New Liberty and Economic Capture. So that actually helps me a little bit.
Okay.
So, but here are a couple of books I actually don't know about.
Right.
I don't know who Robert Paul Wolf is.
Oh.
But he wrote books called In Defense of Anarchism and The Poverty of Liberalism.
Yeah.
I am very interested to hear about those books.
Okay. This was early in my development. As you know, I labeled it, Tom, books important to my intellectual development. And, of course, that could mean that for many of your audience who've read Michael Humer, who've read David Friedman, and of course, obviously, Murray Rothbard, the three great ANCAP people, then maybe In Defense of Anarchism, which is a relatively short book, is not going to be so important to them. But so maybe this is mostly about me. But I think that these books are probably worth picking up. In Defense of Anarchism is really just sort of an essay-length book in which Wolf, who is to this day, I think he's still alive, a left-leaning socialist. So once again, when I talked about Chomsky and talk about Wolf, I'm talking about what I was able to learn from the socialists who do still hate the state. And I think that it's certainly true of Chomsky, and maybe even arguably true of Wolf. Hate the state, even though they're a little confused about the state insofar as they still advocate for conventional socialism. But In Defense of Anarchism is a book in which he simply talks in very stark terms about the subject of autonomy, how important individual autonomy is, and then discusses the various solutions to it via the state, and then sort of reluctantly concludes that there is no way to avoid that if you truly believe in individual autonomy. And individual autonomy not only means rights, but from Wolf's standpoint, it always also means responsibilities. And of course, an obvious analogy, I don't think that Wolf went into that particular analogy, but clearly when the Nazis were hung at Nuremberg, the fact that they were following orders was not a sufficient defense. That if they committed crimes against humanity, even when the state was telling them to do so, and they were just following orders, in that sense, being obedient citizens, that was still a crime for which they could be punished. And therefore, autonomy then means not just that we have rights, but that we also have responsibilities to be true to our own sense of morality. And where that, I guess, still lingers with me is that his argument convinced me that we're in a quandary. And in fact, Wolf, who maybe doesn't quite hate the state. He admitted that he too was in a quandary, in a dilemma. But the quandary is a good one for many of us who still flirt with minarchism, because the quandary is simply that we recognize that we are philosophical anarchists, that we might comply with certain government requests that we don't like, that we don't think are great, just to go along because we think they're trivial. But then when government was going to draft me to fight in the Vietnam War, then my autonomy, my sense of moral responsibility was such that I had to say no. I could have left the country. I could have committed civil disobedience in different ways. I was simply ready to go to prison if they caught up with me. How I managed to dodge the draft is another story in itself. So, but I'm only saying it's a very purely stated, very beautifully put argument that should at least put us all in a quandary and render us all who believe in autonomy basically a philosophical anarchism that we cannot deny, which I'm trying to remember, but I think that when you interviewed Michael Humer, he was almost backing away pragmatically a little bit from his actual proposals, but insisting in the same sense that there's no way to avoid what I would call philosophic anarchy. So that's in defense of anarchism. The poverty of liberalism was also important for me, and only because of one chapter. Now, early on in my development, when I was in my 20s, he talked about the value of community, and he put it in a very sort of pure, beautiful way that he's a philosopher, put it in a way, claims to be a Kantian. And I don't know quite what that is all about because I'm not learned enough. But what he said essentially was that there is a kind of a value beyond our sense of individuality, the value that most of us place on what he referred to as states of reciprocal awareness between people. And he begins, I think, sort of artfully, like a clever philosopher, on states of reciprocal awareness that are actually negative, that the master and servant, or the master and the, so to speak, slave, or let's just say the master and servant, or the boss and the employee. The boss wants the employee to know, I'm boss, and wants the employee to know that he knows, and the employee to know that he knows that he knows. And as Robert Paul Wolf said, if you can acknowledge these sort of nasty cases of reciprocal awareness that people want between each other, then you can acknowledge as well the positive ties that we all seek. And so it turned me, at least philosophically, into being hyper aware of the fact that we all seek community. So that's pretty much it. And I don't know if I'm impressive at anybody to pick that up. Robert Paul Wolf then went on to appallingly do some kind of a weird defense of Marxian labor theory of value. How he was able to do that, I don't know. I looked at the book. It seemed like a real crazy conniption. The assumptions he made were ridiculous. But so he was out of his depth when he did that one. But these are two, I think, beautiful statements of both autonomy and community, and the value that I think most of us see in both of these things.
All right. Well, I'm intrigued now.
Yeah.
Just what I need, Gene. Just what I need. More books to read. Yeah. Thanks
a
lot.
The chapter is relatively short. He writes beautifully, and In Defense of Anarchism is a kind of an essay-length book.
Let's skip ahead to Thomas Sowell, because I love him.
Yeah.
I did a whole episode on his book. Doggone it.
Yeah, no, I have it. I know which one you're referring to. God, I have it.
All right, look, I'm going to go. I'm an old man, am just going to go find
his most recent. Yeah, well, no, indeed, and of course, you had me on to talk about him, and of course, I think you said that you wanted to have him on your show. I've written him a couple of times a while back when I was at Barron's to ask him if he'd do book reviews for me, and he politely declined. Although, in fact, I mean, he does talk to a few people. Perhaps you know that Jason Riley, I mentioned Jason's book, Please Stop Helping Us. Jason is a self-styled conservative, but Jason is really a protege of Thomas Sowell's and has met with him a great deal. Jason is doing a book on Thomas Sowell. And Jason actually spent a couple of hours interviewing me, talking to me about what I thought he should emphasize in that book about Thomas Sowell. It's apparently not going to be a full-scale biography, but it's mostly going to be a sort of intellectual biography.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So I look forward to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the book I was thinking of was A Conflict of Visions.
Yeah, yeah.
Michael Malice and I did an episode.
Oh, that one.
On that book.
You're not even remembering, Tom. You did a solo on the title of which I'm going to, but it was not remember, but it was book basically that attacked the issue of disparate outcomes.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I got a review copy of that book.
Yeah.
When you're talking, I'll go research what the heck the name of that book was.
Yeah.
But I got a review copy in advance of what looked like an appearance by Sowell on the show. Oh. I mean, his people sent me that book for free. So I got at least that. And then it just never was able to happen. So that's why that turned out to be a solo episode, Gene, because the thought was it would be an episode with Sowell.
Sowell is, you know, he was born in 1930. So next year he's turning 90. And that book, you know, there's a couple of years ago. So it's pretty pretty much of an achievement that he was able to write such a book at an advanced stage and an inspiration.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And let me say that, you know, being on the Tom Wood Show may not be his top priority.
Yeah.
And what it puts me in mind of is maybe one of my favorite lines ever uttered on the Tom Wood Show. Yeah. And it was uttered by, of all people, Pat Buchanan.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I was asking him about his analysis of why doesn't Trump do this or that, and it seems strategically he ought to do this. And he started off by saying, well, let me just insert a caveat here.
Yeah.
Because after all, Donald Trump is in the White House, and I'm talking on the Tom Woods Show. That was great.
That was good. Very appropriate. That's what, that taught you humility, Tom. It actually anticipates my philosophical rant that's going to come up in a couple of days. All very true. And indeed, however, Tom Sowell has been so prolific. Although I think that, by the way, part of the secret of Sowell's success is that he keeps mentioning, I'm not going to remember the names, they're almost becoming famous. One of them is I know it's an Asian name of a woman, these two research assistants who seem to be full-time, and that's part of the strength of his writing, that he's so filled with very apt narratives and examples. I mean, his books read like sort of dense Balzacian novels of the, just the reality of the world. Basic Economics is really an attempt, largely quite successful, to sort of make points about the fundamentals of economics by telling a series of narrative examples. And that's one of the main things that makes his writing so lively.
Yes.
And then again, he has these two research assistants whom he's constantly profusely thanking. They probably really mine a great deal for him. That gives a lot of power to his books and to his writing.
No doubt. Now, A Conflict of Visions was one of the ones that over the years people had urged me to read.
Yeah.
As I'd already read some Sowell books, and people said, we got to read Conflict of Visions.
Yeah.
And then the other one that I've been sort of badgered to read over the years is one of the ones you include in your list, which is Knowledge and Decisions.
Oh, yeah.
So well, what's the idea? That, I mean, is it a Hayekian book or is it at another level than that?
It's Hayekian, yeah. And indeed, there too, as I say, I labeled it intellectual development. Look, I however, find, you know, there's a kind of a book that I like to read when I just want to relax and feel a certain amount of joy, you know, a book that sort of enlightens me in a sort of delightful way, certain heavier tomes I save for during the day when I've had a cup of coffee. But almost anything by Sowell is so readable that I could pick up Knowledge and Decisions. And indeed, as you say, it's essentially a very imaginative, and that's probably before he took on those research assistants. So it shows how much he could come up with examples of the basic Hayekian idea. The first sentence in it begins, information is everywhere, but knowledge is rare. And essentially, it's about how knowledge is imparted in the free market. And it's a series of chapters in which he discusses it from different standpoints. The only example that comes to mind is just the communication in the free market of the idea of the Holiday Inn, of the idea that when you're on the road driving across the country, the branding has special value in the marketplace. The branding is such that you know the Holiday Inn is not going to be the Ritz. You know that it's not going to be high end, but you also know that it's not going to be a flea bag. And so branding in an economy in which people are traveling all the time is very important because it conveys a certain kind of quality that you can rely on. And of course, when they put it together, the Holiday Inns, they make sure that they stick to certain standards that keep validating the fact that they keep to the brand. And but also, by the way, you know, the thread that I wrote at the top of my email, do you hate the state? I think that, you know, that of course, the do you hate the state is was an essay by Murray Rothbard. And it sort of pushes the envelope because, you know, you and I might say, well, David Friedman doesn't really hate the state. And that was, of course, Murray's argument. But then some might say, hey, no, maybe David does hate the state. So it's guesswork. It's kind of feel. But I think it was a very important point. I think that Thomas Sowell, for all his supposed conservatism and with respect to foreign policy, certainly he was neoconservative. I think that in so many ways, there is a passion in him that hates the state. And that's why it comes through. There was an essay by Sowell, by the way, in which he, perhaps I've mentioned this before, you're familiar with it. It's the idea that they said that if government has to cut back on its expenditure, suppose that the local government has a statue to Benedict Arnold in the park, or it's running the libraries. Which do you think the government is going to shut down first in order to save money? The Benedict Arnold statue or the libraries? He said, they're going to shut down the libraries, not the Benedict. They're not going to shut down access to the statue or access to the park where you can see the statue, because obviously what they want to do, their tactic, is to make you feel, that's the politicians are going to do this to you. They want to make you feel that they're denying you something that you can really use, and they're going to keep providing you with things that are even obnoxious that you don't want to use at all. And of course, that was written by somebody who I think hates the state.
Well, in the number 7 on your list of books, yeah, where you've got 3 books by Sowell, you then have Jason Riley's book, Please yeah. Stop Helping Us. Yeah. And so you include that with Sowell, although you then skip to number 9 in your list. So maybe Riley was implicitly 8. Yeah. So who knows? But
that's because I can't count, Tom.
So tell me, I mean, is this going to be a book about how affirmative action doesn't help blacks? I mean, what's the idea there?
Well, yeah. No, absolutely. No, indeed. You sound like you diminished it, Tom. And I guess the only point I want to make.
It's just that, I mean, it is a valuable point. And in fact, it was a point that I thought was made very effectively at the Soho Forum, as a matter of fact, by somebody who appears on this list. So we will actually get to that in a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it ties in with Sowell's very bold book, The Economics and Politics of Race. And certainly the fact that Sowell's African-American and Jason Riley is as well, make it easier for them to risk being politically incorrect. The white guy, Charles Murray, who I guess, is he on this list? I guess I didn't put him on the list. There he is. He is on the list. He got into more trouble making this point. But Sowell was absolutely in the economics and politics of race. He was absolutely a great book to read, by the way, uncompromising in making the point about disparate outcomes, making the point that there was an uncanny series of patterns with respect to nationality, race, and ethnicity, with respect to various groups. Because, I mean, of course, his point about the Jews and the Chinese was fairly typical let me take his least politically correct point. He made a point about the Mexicans and the Japanese. And he said that if you take the Mexicans who live in California, the Japanese who live in California, prejudice against them, certainly since World War II over the decades, was about the same. And then on top of that, the Japanese were put in internment camps during World War II and stripped of their property. And only their parents years later were given some of it back. But they were clearly a very dislocated group. That's one comparison. And then he pointed out, how is it that currently the Japanese in California have a higher material standard of living than the average non-Japanese in California, but the Mexicans have a lower standard of living? How is that the case? And then he compared Mexico with Japan. Mexico, a country rich in natural resources, Japan bereft of natural resources. How is it the Japanese standard of living in Japan is much higher than in Mexico? So if we have those two comparisons, rather nasty kind of thing to say. And what is he saying? He said, obviously he's saying, I'm not saying that Mexicans are not decent people, as good as anybody else. Obviously, nobody's going to accuse him of that. He said, but there are cultural differences that stare you in the face. There are cultural differences about economic success that stare you in the face, and that it's silly to deny these facts, especially since, you know, the affirmative action people are telling us that we should look for equal outcomes. So this rather outrageous statement and rather outrageous series of analyses came out of Thomas Sowell. He set the standard and the example. And by the way, when he talked about the Jews, I mean, this is a bit of a revelation to me, the economics and politics of race, because, of course, he was the one who brought home Gary Becker's point that under capitalism, if any country has any kind of vestige of capitalism, then if given half a chance, the Jews and the Chinese and the Japanese are going to be richer than everybody else because they're just good at these things. This is deep in their culture. They're hardworking. They save money. They're entrepreneurial. So they are going to be richer than the people who oppress them. And then the tragic part of his vision, which I think in a way he didn't clarify enough, the tragic part of his vision was to say that while the progressives think that races like the Jews, like the Japanese, like the Chinese who are oppressed are never going to get on top economically, they always do. But does that do them any good in the final analysis? Well, the Chinese were obviously pariah in Malaysia for owning most of the businesses. The Jews clearly became pariah in Germany and in much of Europe for being as successful as they were. And the Japanese also became under suspicion for no good reason in California. So that's the tragic element in Sowell's vision. And Jason Riley picked up on this, but it's not just about affirmative action. Jason Riley is a dark-skinned Black, and he has, throughout his life, experienced racial profiling. So his personal stories are quite striking. He went to the University of Buffalo, and he lived off campus, I think, for the last 3 years, and he drove to school every morning. And en route, he was stopped by the cops twice a week, just because he's a Black kid driving a car. And he started to take alternative routes in order to avoid the cops. When he moved to New York City, he said that he was dealt with some suspicion in restaurants. But then he tells a personal story that he worked in a convenience store while working his way through college. And he found that, and he was on the lookout for pilferers, for people who'd steal from the store. And he said, I found myself racially profiling people who looked like me. He said, because I found that people who looked like me were the people who were more likely than anybody else to pilfer something from the store. And then he says boldly, he says, look, even middle-class Blacks, if they're walking on the street and they see a bunch of disreputable Black teenagers coming their way, they too will cross the street. So he sort of boldly says, you know, that if I cross the street too, I'm not affronting the individuality of these kids who look disreputable. Am I really insulting them personally? I'm just taking the precaution that anybody has to take in this society. So it's a very sort of, he writes about this with no resentment at all. And by the way, I had Jason as a one-on-one in Junto, the quasi-debating society I used to run. And Jason told us the story that evening with a laugh. He said he was in at Brooks Brothers looking for ties to buy that morning. And the saleswoman is following around wherever he goes, just sort of keeping an eye on him. And he was laughing about that. And I said, Jason, you're a respectable looking guy. But I think what Jason knows is he's very dark skinned and he's a young looking guy under suspicion. So again, Jason is quite a tonic and has the same courage and boldness that Thomas Sowell does talking about these very difficult issues.
All right, let's move to a book that maybe you didn't expect me to mention because it's not quite as hardcore as the other books.
Oh.
But I'm intrigued when you say that this is the way you portrayed it when you were introducing Peter in the debate on affirmative action, namely the book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better.
Yeah.
You said this is a book that works with your, or can work with your moderate friends.
Yeah.
It can be a gateway drug to libertarianism. I haven't read it. I'm curious to know, what is it about this book? What's the nature of his argument that might appeal to the non-ideologically committed person?
Well, I did a review of it. I hadn't met Peter before I reviewed it. And of course, I call it a gateway drug to libertarianism only because Peter is, because having had a couple of dinners with him, I know him well by now, he's sort of in a personal dilemma because he voted for Obama both times and no doubt voted for Hillary. And so he sort of holds on to his Democrat with a capital D kind of attitude. And yet, he is so honest empirically that when he decided to do a book about the things that began to stare him in the face, by the way, he's a professor of law emeritus from Yale, but he takes a huge interest in empirical issues. And he began to see so many ways in which government fails us that he felt called upon to do a book about it. And so what's my simple point? My simple point is only that you're going to read a book by a guy who's a Democrat with a capital D, and yet he acknowledges public choice theory. And although, by the way, he actually does a beautiful job in discussing it because he allows for all the exceptions that, you know, the idea that it's irrational for us to vote, as indeed it is irrational for us to take any trouble to vote, because how is our one vote going to make a difference and all the rest of it? And he says, well, but people frequently do act irrationally. They do go to the more than you'd think are rational, clearly, go to the polls to vote. And so he sees a lot of exceptions, but he points out, look, in the end, public choice theory is quite valid. People will not take the time and rationally not take the time to really follow the issues. And so he grants all that. And then he brings you through a series of horror stories about the crazy bureaucracies. I'm mentioning only that he zeroes in on Elizabeth Warren, who at one point was said with a straight face that the student loan program was earning a profit. And this is somebody who's supposedly sophisticated, as Peter Schuck pointed out. It was earning a profit because of an analysis that assumed that the risk of the student loans was similar to the risk of government treasury bonds and bills. That's what she said with a straight face. And so he brings you through a series of appalling stories about government failure. And then, as I say, in my opinion, ends a little lamely on how it can do better. And I ended my review by saying, really, you're going to be persuaded it can do a lot better by doing far less. You know, that's really what Peter Schuck persuades us of. And when I met him, I said, Peter, really, that's what you convinced us of. And Peter, of course, is very tolerant, open-minded guy. And he said, well, so be it. You know, he's open-minded about that. But as a gateway drug to libertarianism, lend it to your progressive friends, because it is very readable. And hopefully they'll feel they're in good hands. A Democrat with a capital D. Oh, no, he talks about how it is with great sadness and reluctance that I report on all these things. So that's the point. You know, he's sad and reluctant, but he's very energetic in telling these horror stories.
All right, let's we'll go a little bit over just to include one more book.
Okay.
You have three books here by Charles Murray, Losing Ground, What It Means to Be a Libertarian, and Coming Apart.
Yeah.
Now, I'm familiar with all three, but I've read only Losing Ground.
Oh.
And I wrote to him some time ago because I did have him on the show once, but we didn't talk about Losing Ground. And I asked him what he thought of, because apparently there is some social science literature that takes him to task for the thesis of Losing Ground that says that it's not really so that single motherhood and all that is being encouraged by these government policies and all that. That at the very least, it's data that he needs to take into account for his thesis. And what's your response to all this? And his answer to me was, I haven't kept up with any of that. And that was his entire answer.
Did he really say that?
Yeah, I haven't kept up with any of that. So now I don't even know how valid. But on the other hand, there are, you know, when they did the Denver and Seattle income maintenance experiments, and they said, you know, you're going to get this certain amount of money regardless, it did have a huge negative effect on marriage and these other metrics, except in Gary, Indiana. And so they looked at what was it? Well, because in Gary, Indiana, people were under the false impression that if they got divorced, they'd lose the money.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, apparently it did have some kind of effect on people's behavior after all. Yeah. But I was just left kind of wondering what to make of the situation when he had no answer to what I was asking. So do you want to pick one of these
I guess I just have hopefully answer this way. You know, I had a long dinner with Charles Murray. I followed him. He comes to New York these days, not infrequently. As a matter of fact, he's working on a new book. I'm trying to get him. I think he will be willing to defend the book at the Soho Forum. And but I mention that only because he's a complicated person. I put that euphemistically. In a way, he's like Robert Nozick. Robert Nozick, that's Anarchy, State, and Utopia. He backed away from his own book. Robert Nozick, in a book that he wrote a number of years later, after Anarchy, State, and Utopia, specifically repudiated key elements in his book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. And Charles Murray, who's got a couple of hobby horses, when I heard him about 2 years ago, I raised my hand and I said to Charles, you know, you've just said something that I'm sitting here, I'm hearing Charles Murray repudiate the thesis of Coming Apart. Tom, in Coming Apart, that's all about the decline in labor force participation rate of men. It's all about things like specifically the huge increase in disability payments, the revolution in disability payments that has continued to decimate the labor force participation rate of men 25 to 54. He's been solidly documenting just the overwhelming evidence and hard to refute that obviously government policies do foster dropouts from the labor force. Losing ground is pretty solidly argued. And while obviously you mentioned Gary and Diane, I was all set for you to say, well, it didn't happen there for a good reason. You know, it doesn't always happen, but the idea that the dole makes a difference, I think, has been overwhelmingly demonstrated by Charles Murray. He deserves credit for having boldly written this book. It was published in 1981, Losing Ground. And this was at a time when it was very politically incorrect to say such things. Others have picked up his thesis. Nick Eberstadt, you probably familiar with him. He's at American Enterprise Institute. He's picked up on the thesis, written a lot of good things about it, about the decline of work among prime age men. So overwhelmingly, it's the case. And obviously, I guess it unsettles progressives to admit to it, but it's undeniable. Now, I have mixed feelings about Charles. Charles, as we're speaking about him generally, those are the only three books of Charles's that I would recommend. And Coming Apart is relatively recent, in which, by the way, what he does is he focuses only on the white population. And he does that because he wants to make it clear that he's not singling out blacks, that the effect of government policies to discourage work and discourage participation in the workforce. Or he wrote in Coming Apart, he said, in the 1950s, men, prime age men who didn't work were called bums. They were called street corner men. They were condemned. I mean, he writes uncompromisingly about that. And in Coming Apart, it's strictly about whites, where he picks his data in order to show it's true of working class whites as well. He defended himself by pointing out in the book, he says, well, there's always the argument, well, they're not given job opportunities. He said, well, look at the 1990s. The unemployment rate was down to 4%, 3.9%. There was an explosion of employment. We put it to the test in those days. Of course, we're putting it to the test again today with an unemployment rate of below 4%. And so he vigorously defended himself, but he waxes and wanes and backs away from his own thesis, as he did at that time, because his hobby horse is now a guaranteed annual income. He wrote a book about that. And then his hobby horse as well, where I saw somebody really take him apart, is the idea that this time is different. The robots are taking all our jobs. So he's a very mixed bag. But I also want to recommend What It Means to Be a Libertarian. It's libertarian light, but I do think that too is a book that you might want to recommend to a progressive friend after he reads Peter Schuck, because it's a very sort of good, sort of thoughtful piece about what libertarianism means to him. He makes a couple of small mistakes about certain aspects of economics, but he gets into some two very good points. One is an imaginative thought experiment in What It Means to Be a Libertarian, in which he talks about how, what if we didn't abolish all regulation at all? We kept the regulatory agencies, but we allowed any business to opt out of regulatory constraints so long as it put prominently on the label of its products and prominently on the label of all its outlets, we have decided to be exempt from all government regulation. And then, of course, he said, the other businesses that decide to stick with government regulation could say, we proudly abide by all government regulation. So he said, just let that happen, as long as they advertise that they're opting out, and let the buyer beware, and then see what will happen. And it goes into, I think, a very persuasive point that since there are so many dumb and crazy regulations, and since companies wanted to defend their brand, the regulated businesses will quickly find it almost impossible to compete with the unregulated businesses, the businesses that have opted out. I think it was an imaginative point. The other point he goes into, which ties in with my affection for the argument for community in the poverty of liberalism, is his point that we have lost the sense of community precisely because we're not libertarian enough, that government has usurped so many of the powerful community functions of taking care of the elderly in particular, of being of running our own communities in particular. We crave community, but we now spend our weekends at the amusement parks rather than passively recognizing that we do want to take care of grandma and grandpa and make them a part of our lives. And I mean, he elaborates on that even further in terms of his own personal love of community and his point that a libertarian society would foster voluntarily community rather than discourage it. So again, he's somebody, I think, in those three books who's left writings that are really worth reading, even though in certain other ways he's abandoned his integrity. The story you just told me really is surprising that he could even say he's not up with the data when he published a book called Coming Apart.
All right. So what I'm going to do is link to, as I say, I'll do it separately. I have a section on the books we covered here and the section on books that were in your list that we didn't cover. Mm-hmm. That'll all be at tomwoods.com/1554.
Yeah.
And we have arrived now. Okay. We are on the eve of the, if you can believe it, the final day of Gene Epstein Week. And in the final day of Gene Epstein Week, Gene is going to share different pearls of wisdom with us. We'll just put it that way. It's going to put an exclamation mark on Gene Epstein Week. So do not miss that one, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.